Good morning. Thank you. Thank you all for being here today for Zazenkai. These days of silent sitting that we have during the Shilla Ango are very important. It's a bit like a ship. It has to have both an anchor and sails. Is this coming through okay? If we have only the sails and no anchor, we're blown about in our lives by every passing wind and every incident. If we only have an anchor, we don't move, we're stuck. Zazen at the temple is our anchor. Our mindfulness practice in the world, our sails. Zazenkai reconnects us to our anchor. It's very easy in the Shilla Ango when the Doksan schedule is cut back. Our teacher is not around so much to back off of one sitting practice, get a little bit lost. But the Shilla Ango is not about changing from one mode to another like throwing a switch. It's just a small change in emphasis. And over time, even that difference will eventually disappear into a seamless practice of just being in the world, but not of the world, as they say. So we must not cease from the practice of Zazen or even cut back significantly just because there are more activities that are outside the center and don't involve Seshin and koans and that side of it. It's never an easy balance to maintain. Everyone has to find their own. The Buddha was one of the most publicly involved people in all of history. He had literally no home. He was constantly on the move with this huge entourage of monks and nuns and running a floating sangha of that size would tax the most organized mind. And yet he remained available to any seeker and still managed to find time to do daily Zazen along with the 3-month retreat during the monsoon. So it can be done, but it is walking a tightrope. We all do the best we can. Today we'll take a look at a koan that addresses this issue to some extent. It's a case in the Mumonkan. As many of you know, the Mumonkan is the first of the 4 classical collections of koans that we study as part of the curriculum in this lineage. The Mumonkan was compiled by Zen Master Mumon in the latter part of the Song Dynasty. His Chinese name was Wu Men, so the title is really Wu Men Quan, which means the gateless barrier. Mumon collected 48 cases, which are, for the most part, very short accounts of the sayings and doings of the great Chinese Zen masters, in which they demonstrate directly the truth about ourselves and the universe. The job of the student is to get inside the skin of the master and demonstrate that same truth in Doksan. And then Master Mumon added a commentary and a verse by way of expanding on the case and helping us along in working on it. And with this particular koan, his commentary and verse are every bit as significant as the main case, as we shall see. It's case number 8 in the Mumonkan. Ketchu builds carts. The case reads, "The priest Getan said to a monk, 'Ketchu made 100 carts. If you take off both the wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent?'" Mumon's commentary: "If you realize this directly, your eye is like a shooting star and your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning." And Mumon's verse: Where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. The 4 cardinal half points above, below, north, south, east, west. Getan said Ketchu made 100 carts. If you take off both the wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? We don't know a great deal about Getan, whose Chinese name is Yue An. He was a Dharma ancestor of Mumon in the line of Rinzai and lived in the late 11th or early 12th century, according to Robert Aitken Roshi. Ketchu, whose Chinese name would be Xie Cheng, made 100 carts. What about these carts of Ketchu? And who was Ketchu anyway? Why did Getan use him as his example? I mean, carts are carts, aren't they? Why didn't the master just say, "Hey guys, there's this cart outside that we use to haul stuff around the monastery. If you take off the wheels and axle, what have you got?" What's so special about Ketchu's carts? Well, Ketchu is a shadowy legend of prehistoric China. He's credited with inventing the wheel and cart. He is said to have lived during the Xia dynasty sometime in the second millennium BCE. Historians are not even certain that there was a Xia dynasty. So Ketchu is not just some guy that built a bunch of carts. He exists in a very deep place, embedded in China's ancient past. He's the inventor of the wheel and the wheeled vehicle, a major underpinning of civilization. So Ketchu is a myth. He is a Promethean figure, the demigod who gave civilization to China. Now, what is a myth? Classically, myths are defined as stories, legends that arise in pre-literate societies, and they persist because they contain very powerful images that help a society or a culture define itself. And as the culture defines itself, so do the individuals in that culture. We tend to define ourselves by our cultural myths. So as human beings, we seem to have a deep need for myth. Anyone who's watched Bill Moyer's interviews of Joseph Campbell on public television, or who has read Campbell's books on myth, can readily see that myths and myth-making are part of every culture, and that there are many common threads that run through them. Death and resurrection, the mythic journeys in search of some treasure like the Holy Grail, the trials that a young person must endure to achieve responsible adulthood, and, as we see here, the bringer of light or fire, a special knowledge, or a wheel and cart. And we know also that myths are a very powerful aspect of religious practice. Here in our temple, we celebrate the myths and legends of the Buddha, his birth, his life, his great enlightenment, his teachings, and his entry into Parinirvana. Many of the koans we work on are based on myth. The Buddha on Vulture Peak hands over the robe and bowl to Mahakasyapa. The Bodhisattva Manjushri questions Vimalakirti. And of course, at every Vesak, we tell the Jataka tales over and over. Myths provide comfort and solace in times of difficulty or sorrow. And they provide inspiration for us to continue our efforts. How many times in Sesshin, when we're in a dark place, has the Roshi or the Tanto told a story drawn from the life of the Buddha or some other figure in or out of our tradition? A story of struggle and sacrifice that gives us the will to go on. Ketchu is a myth of the ancient past, but that doesn't make him any less real. But in looking at the story of Ketchu's carts, mean, it may not be affected all that much because this particular myth is not part of the Western tradition. To get an idea of the impact of Master Gettan's question on the monks at his temple, imagine a Christian priest or minister saying to his devout flock, "Christ died on the cross. Yank out the nails, take down the horizontal beam, pull the upright out of the ground, and what have you got?" Or if a mullah says to his congregation, "Take apart the tomb of the prophet stone by stone." Or if a rabbi said, "Take apart the Ark of the Covenant, pull out the scrolls and scatter them." Or if a Buddhist teacher said, "Take down the altars, scatter the incense pots, the flower holders, and the figures and relics of Buddha and Bodhisattvas. Take all the books out of the library." Now that starts to get you where you live. In a more contemporary vein, one of the most reviled books to be published in recent history is A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. In it, Zinn challenges many of the myths surrounding such historical figures as Christopher Columbus, George Washington, Samuel Adams, Andrew Jackson. Now, whether or not Zinn's take on American history is more or less accurate than more traditional accounts is not the point here. The challenge alone elicited an incredibly vitriolic response from many critics that had nothing to do with history. It shows how quickly a cultural or religious myth can become very, very personal. So Gettan is asking his monks and us to give up a deep personal myth. Take it apart. Cast away the pieces. What is it that, if threatened with its loss, we pursue with a single-minded intensity even to our own destruction, even as that sad and twisted character Gollum in The Lord of the Rings pursued his precious? What is our most dearly held possession? It's that separate entity we call the self. It's the hardest thing in the world to give it up. Yet give it up we must. We have to take apart this fundamental myth of self and see what is left. What is it that becomes vividly apparent? This challenge disturbs our sleep, but most of us don't want our sleep disturbed any more than traditional historians wanted to be disturbed by Howard Zinn. We want to continue in our dream that we think of as objective reality. But of course, it's the job of the Zen teacher to disturb our sleep, to grab us by the shoulder and give it a shake. Say, "Wake up! Wake up!" Looking at our personal myths and letting go of them is not a comfortable thing to do. In fact, many find it impossible. How many of us, when facing a choice between, on the one hand, a severe diminution of the ego, loss of self-image, loss of self, and on the other hand, death of the physical body, unhesitatingly choose the latter? Death before dishonor. Better dead than red. Give me liberty or give me death. Before I let that steam drill beat me down, I'll die with my hammer in my hand. Now, there's a kind of nobility in some of these sayings, and they represent a sacrifice of a sort. But at the same time, there are strings attached. There's a quid pro quo. My life for honor, or freedom, or whatever the cause one uses to define the self. Katagiri Roshi calls this kind of giving currying favor. It's not really giving. It's not selfless giving. There are some masters who literally did give their lives, but they did it in a very different way. They did it as pure offering. Nothing held back, nothing expected, no quid pro quo. Ganto sat in Zazen while bandits raided his temple. And when they killed him, he let out a yell that was heard for miles. That was his offering. The 24th Indian ancestor, Aryasimha, allowed his head to be cut off by an angry king, saying, "Since this body is not mine, how can I begrudge the head?" That was his offering, a true gift, no strings attached. The Buddha, in a former life as a prince, gave up his life in order that a tiger might live and raise her cubs. Did he expect anything? I don't think so. Getan asks us to give up our lives, ourselves, for nothing, to abandon our lives, ourselves, bit by bit, in our practice. That is our offering, our relinquishment. And how do we do this? How do we take off the wheels and the axle? Well, of course, it's the practice. Thoughts come up, let them go. Notions, images, fantasies, ideas, scenarios, let them go. It's not about destroying anything, just letting go. Letting go into mu, into the counting, into the breath, into the sitting. It's not easy. Sometimes it can be very, very painful. There are times when letting go of our most cherished thoughts, ideas, images, myths of and about ourselves over and over and over again, each time they crop up, can feel like you're pulling out your own guts inch by inch. This self is more ancient than Ketchu. It stems from the beginningless beginning. Remember the purification gata, which begins, "All evil karma created by me since time immemorial." Time immemorial. Yeah, that's a while back. We don't even really know what myths about ourselves we are attached to until they're challenged. I'd be embarrassed to tell you how many times I discover and rediscover some insane attachment that I didn't even know was there until one day it was challenged. So we challenge ourselves. Look at our inventory of attachments. How will we feel if things are suddenly taken away from us? Take away your bank accounts, your possessions. You're impoverished. Take away your house, your apartment. You're homeless. Take away your clothes, your shoes, your suits and coats, all that stuff in your closet at home. You are naked. Take away your job, your profession, your skills. You have no calling. Take away your dignity, your notions about deportment and proper behavior. You're a fool. Take away your family and friends, relationships, all whom you love. You are alone. Take away your gender. You have no sexual identity. Take away your name. You are nameless. Is that everything? No, not yet enough. Take away your eyes. You're blind. Take away your hearing. You're deaf. Take away your speech. You are mute. Take away all your bodily sensations of touch, heat, and cold. You are completely isolated. Take away your thoughts, your feelings, your imaginings, your speculations, all your mental activity. You are an imbecile. Is there anything left? If there is, take it away. Is there nothing left? Take that away. And then take away your practice. Take away taking away. let go of letting go. You are utterly adrift. The wheels have come off. The axle taken away. It is in this letting go of all our attachments to all things that we liberate all things and ourselves as well. One does not have to make a great effort. If you just attend to the practice for a long time, all this will happen of itself. Attachments will fall away like leaves from a tree in autumn, and you will become homeless, impoverished, and mad in the most wonderful way. Ketchu made 100 carts. If you take off both wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? What is it that becomes vividly apparent? Only our complete liberation, our birthright. In the 10th Oxford in picture, the homeless, nameless one enters the marketplace, utterly free to consort with merchants and thieves, priests and prostitutes. A mountain is no longer a mountain. It is indescribable. A rock is not a rock. It is the universe. Flower is no longer beautiful. It pierces your heart. Vividly apparent. Oh my, yes. Woman's commentary. If you realize this directly, your eye is like a shooting star, and your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning. Master Mumon lays it all out for us here. You see instantly, clearly, exactly what is with no obstruction. How can you not? There is no longer a myth about self or other hanging like a veil over your eyes and ears. You act with complete freedom, unobstructed and unencumbered. You hold nothing, you cling to nothing, you carry nothing. Your eye is like a shooting star. It is the eye of the Buddha Shakyamuni when he saw the morning star. It's the eye of Master Ryuin, who wandered for 30 years and one day saw pink peach blossoms and came to awakening. It's the eye of the carpenter as he measures for the saw, the eye of the shepherd watching the flock, the eye of the physician examining a patient, the eye of the cook watching the soup come to a simmer on the stove, the eye of a child entranced by a circus clown. And it's also ears, tongue, nose, body, all our senses. The mother instantly recognizes the sound of her child. The musician hears exactly the sound of the instrument. The baker feels when the dough is ready for the oven. The truth appears there being no delusion. Dogen. Freely I see a flying bird and trace its path. Secho, you don't have to look. You don't have to listen. Your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning. The hand that picks up the cup of tea, the hand that feeds and cares for a child, the hand that pets the cat and washes the dishes and makes the incision at the beginning of a surgical procedure. These are the thousand hands and eyes of Guan Yin. Guan Yin, Kanon, is often depicted with 1,000 arms radiating up from her body. And each hand contains an eye. To see clearly and to act are not separate. The mirror mind reflects the reality with perfect accuracy and with no hesitation whatsoever, just as it always has and always will. There are no gaps. Breathing Mu. Where is the gap? breathing one. Where's the gap? The bell rings, we bow and stand up. Where's the gap? Drinking tea, the lightning is snatched. All things come forth in perfect harmony, just as they always have and always will. It's not a goal we have to strive for. It is the reality right now for every one of us. We just don't know it. Not yet. Mumon's verse. Where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. The four cardinal half points above, below, north, south, east, west. Engo, Yuan Wu, commentator on the Hekigan Roku, wrote, "Even the Buddhas of past, present, and future cannot catch sight of it. Even a master cannot follow it." And yet, we constantly describe things. We think about them, we define them, we verbalize them, all in a kind of desperate and futile effort to convince ourselves that we have our own separate existence. We have some sort of control over something. All the equations that Einstein ever came up with, all the calculations of Newton don't even begin to reach it. The instant we try to describe, to explain, we're lost in a sea of words and thoughts and concepts divorced from the reality of our nature. The physicist Richard Feynman once told a story about his father. When Richard was a boy, he had a little red wagon, as most boys do. Well, one day there was a ball in the wagon, and Richard noticed that every time he pulled the wagon forward, the ball rolled to the back of the wagon. He asked his father why this was so. His father replied that nobody knows. It's called inertia, but nobody really knows what that is. Feynman's comment on this was that his father was a very wise man. He knew the difference between really understanding something and just putting a name to it. My own experience teaching anatomy is something like that. As some of you know, I teach anatomy in a rather unique way. Students build muscles and other structures of the human body out of modeling clay. And then they put them on a specially designed model of the human skeleton. It's about 30 inches high. It's a wonderful experiential form of learning of what is usually a dry and impossible list of names. It's a fun way to learn. Most people love it. But occasionally I meet resistance. And that resistance comes, not surprisingly, from people who already know or think they know anatomy. Some people would much rather hang on to the names than demonstrate an experience, because names are so much easier and they seem so secure. We put a name to something and we think we've nailed it down, but it's a false security. The simplest action is utterly unfathomable. Who can even begin to describe this? How much time and energy do we spend describing our lives to ourselves? The psychologist Julian James coined the term narratization. We narrate our lives, our hopes, dreams, speculations, ideas, loves, hates, and all the rest of it. We reduce our unfathomable, mysterious, divine lives, our vast, wide, infinite, and eternal self, in all caps, into a bunch of words and concepts. If even a master can't follow it, what in heaven's name makes us think we can, much less control it? The wheel turns, it walks, it talks, it laughs, it cries, it eats, it sleeps. Who can describe any of it? Just let the wheel turn. Stop all your groping and maneuvering. Let it turn, 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 and it will manifest throughout the universe. the four cardinal half points above, below, north, south, east, west. The universe gets along just fine. It doesn't depend on our thought, speculation, or imagining. Do not try to describe Mu. Do not think about Mu. Do not speculate upon Mu. Do not imagine Mu. Do not visualize Mu. It's not about knowing in that sense. It's not even about discovering Mu, so much as letting Mu discover you. In the beginning, we try to enter into the practice, but it is the practice that enters into us. Let go the wheels, the axle, the seats, the fenders, the running boards, and all of it. And therein we find our freedom. This is very well summarized by a verse. Die while alive and be thoroughly dead. Then do what you will. All will be well. But be careful. There is a trap here. Step two can't happen without step one. It is only to the extent that the notion of the separate self has died that we have the freedom to do what we will. It's an exact one-to-one ratio. Lacking that, the notion of freedom becomes a false notion and a recipe for disaster. Like the bumper sticker says, freedom is not free. That's why we work toward the goal that none of us has truly reached yet. And we have the precepts, the paramitas, all the skillful means of the masters and of our own Roshi to help us. We must not cease from the practice of Zazen. The separate ego self can bounce back. Those axles and wheels have a habit of reassembling themselves when we least expect it. How many times, however, in discussion groups and talks, have we all heard someone say something like, well, I was planning to do such and such. I had my day all worked out, and then I got a phone call, and I had to drop everything and go do something else. I was really upset about it, and I'd be angry and resentful, thinking I wanted to be somewhere else doing something else. But then I realized, no, this is what I'm doing today. That's the freedom we're talking about here. It sounds so simple, and I guess it is, but it's a hard, hard-won freedom. The freedom that says, this is what I'm doing right here, right now. That's the gift, the relinquishment. The Buddha did not remain under the Bo tree in the bliss of Satori. He relinquished nirvana. He got up, went out into the world to help people. But be careful again. He did not do it with an idea that the world was a mess and that he was going to go out and fix it. Dido Lori calls this dharma attachment. He writes, it's like those who say, everybody should be a Buddhist. The world is so screwed up because everyone is not a Buddhist. If everyone became a Buddhist, there would be peace on earth. That's the worst kind of delusion. What the Buddha realized was that if he remained there under the tree, he was incomplete. His practice was incomplete. The universe was incomplete. Even the Buddha's supreme enlightenment experience was only that, an experience. It was not full enlightenment until he got up. So that's what he did. He became continuous enlightened action. He became the turning wheel manifesting throughout the universe. For every step backward we take into the deep realization of emptiness, we can take a step forward into the worlds as husbands, wives, partners, parents, children, workers, customers, therapists, clients, drivers, passengers. Whatever happens to us is a gift, and whatever we do is an offering. We become the turning wheel manifesting throughout the universe. This is the life of the Bodhisattva. Together with all beings, we attain Buddhahood.